Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
This is part two of a Bob and Richard Answered Your Question show. We've asked in several venues for our listeners to submit questions, and boy, have you responded. Thank you very much. First question. I'm about 30 years old and have enjoyed casino AP for the last 10 years, but really don't see myself wanting to spend any significant amount of time in casinos for much longer, and it's not something I see myself doing when I'm 35 plus. AP has never been my primary source of income. So far, I've been able to maintain a pretty clean name. One OSN entry from many, many years ago, zero bio entries, and really zero heat anywhere right now. I'm debating going on a pseudo-kamikaze mission all across the country, and maybe the world, trying to take as much money as possible, going for the throat. This would obviously result in heating myself up all over and probably trashing my name and face and planning to retire casino AP forever. I would be playing on a bankroll of about $1 million. Pro, get lots of money now with plans to never return. Con, name, face will be dead, so tough to turn back once decision is made. Richard, go ahead.
Well, I have a very strong opinion about this, and my opinion is that it would be a real mistake. First of all, I've retired from AP four or five times. And, you know, like Michael Corleone, they keep pulling me back in. You just never know. I one time, long before Don Johnson ever did his play, I had an opportunity that was very similar to that. Getting the bankroll to play it was not an issue. The problem was, there was no way in the world that I could show up at a casino and put $2 million on deposit and start playing because, yeah, unfortunately, I am in the system. And when it's that kind of money, they are going to find out who you are. So having a clean name and a clean face has real value. And I think it would be a big mistake to just completely burn yourself out when you are clean currently, because you just don't know. The other thing I've learned is, through life, you are given opportunities by the people you've met along the way. So guys who were friends of mine from years ago call you up and go, hey, do you want to get involved? We're doing this project. You know, we're going to, whatever it is, you know what I mean? And I think that's true of everyone I know. You get calls from people who, when a project happens, and you don't know when some gambling project is going to happen 10 years down the road where one of your friends thinks of you and says, hey, we're going to go do this. Do you want to come along? And the EV is going to be $2,000 an hour. You know, you would kick yourself if you had burned out your good name. The other thing is, what if you just want to go for the comps, right? 5 years from now, obviously you have plenty of money already, right? You have $1 million at 30 years old. I'm sure you're going to go into some career where you're going to make a lot of money. Well, 5 years from now, you want to take a great vacation, say in the Bahamas, and you figure, why pay for it? I'll play enough just to get a comp. Well, if your name is no good, that's no longer an option, you know? So anyway, I would say definitely do not go burn yourself out.
Let me do a little counterargument. Richard, you in particular have exceptional skills in both being an AP and also in networking. I don't know the guy who sent us this email, but possibly he was a loner and there was no real possibility that somebody's going to offer him a chance in the future for a gambling opportunity. Would that change your answer?
It wouldn't, because I'm looking at what can you make, right? So a good example is, we had someone on our show who went by the name Casey, And he did exactly this. He got an RV. He traveled all over the country and just burned himself out everywhere. He was making a documentary movie about it that happened 10 or 12 years ago that still has never come out. But and I think he was able to win $500,000 or $600,000. And I just think you could easily come across an opportunity down the road that would be worth that much or more. You know, you're only 30 years old or whatever, so there are going to be a lot of opportunities down the road that I think could easily amount to more than $500,000 or $600,000.
You live in a different world than I do.
Well, here I would also say this. The thought of traveling around the country and just burning myself out, to me, I would rather stick needles in my eyes. I mean, that sounds like a horrible way to spend my time. I would hate that. But maybe you're one of those people who really doesn't care, right? You have asbestos underwear and you're willing to just go in and put it in their face until they throw you out, you know?
Okay, good. All right, we've beaten this up enough. Mr. Yuck said he had way too many post office boxes to count. Does this imply that you get better mailers by being a local than being from out of town? Probably, but every casino has its own theories about this. The mailers are different, with locals typically getting more free play more frequently and out-of-towners getting room and food offers. If you get local offers, you need a way to pick up free play, especially if you live hundreds or thousands of miles away. Casinos are on the lookout for one player picking up free play for multiple players, so be careful if you let someone else do this for you. Also, next week's show, Russell Fox, tax advisor, is going to talk about this. We've already pre-taped this show. And there can be tax implications. For example, if you live in Washington and get California mailboxes because you're trying to be a local at some California casino, the Franchise Tax Board in California is going to come after you heavily for tax considerations, even though you're a Washington resident.
Yeah. So, yes, the offers are probably better, but there are other issues to keep in mind.
All right. Another question. In video poker, when is a session supposed to end? Is it determined by a percentage of bankroll won or lost, or should they last a predetermined amount of time? Often I see video poker players practicing what I call a hit-and-run method, whereby they jump on a machine and once they make any kind of substantial hit, they leave and go to another machine. Are these skilled players or more just gamblers using a flawed system? There is no mathematical advantage to changing machines after a big hit, or after a dry spell for that matter, or after 1.5 hours, or whatever. The best predictor of what will happen in the next few hours is expected value of the game multiplied by your accuracy level, plus the slot club, plus various promotions that are going on. Whether the machine has been hot or cold over the last how many minutes is totally irrelevant. However, there can be reasons to change machines. If you had 3 times drawing tickets from 5 to 7 p.m., the game's going to be worth less at 7:05 than it was at 6:55. That could make a difference in your decision. Maybe you need 80,000 points a month to keep diamond level offers coming, or 2,000 points today get you a free buffet or some other gift you deem desirable. Or maybe you only can concentrate on video poker for 1 hour at a time before you go buggy. Or your wife insists you watch Dancing with the Stars with her. All those would be reasonable reasons to stop a session. Running out of cash on hand could be a reason to stop. If you don't have money close at hand, going to an ATM machine at a casino is rarely a good idea. Those machines have very high fees associated with them. If it's a great play, it's really expensive EV-wise to run out of money. So smart players try to have access to plenty of cash, whether you bring it or have a safety deposit box at the casino or a line of credit or whatever.
Yeah, and you left out the biggest reason to change machines. Somebody sits down near you who's smoking.
That can be a good reason.
That often can be a reason for me to leave a machine. Usually in my own case, I go in planning to play a certain amount of coin in. So, you know, usually that's what I'm aiming to do, and that's when I get up and leave. So, although, as I say, smoking or, you know, sometimes really loud Wheel of Fortune machine that somebody starts playing near me can drive me away.
Willy Wonka can do that, too.
Yeah.
He's a video poker player in Europe, has found a game that he plays 20 hours a week. He says he gets no heat and wants to know if he can play more than that without raising suspicion. Also, he wants some advice on Hollywooding when he gets a jackpot to disguise that he's a pro. Well, I've never played video poker in Europe. I haven't asked Richard, but I doubt it. So I really don't know the lay of the land there. Any speculation I gave would be just that, uneducated speculation. In the United States, it's not uncommon for a player to have a favorite machine. I assume that's true in Europe as well, but I just don't know. I don't know how much the machine is losing for the casino or how much records they keep. I don't even know if you have an advantage at all. Maybe you've just been lucky. I can't be more help. I just don't have the information to help you.
Yeah, I would say, though, that assuming what you say is true, I don't think there's any problem playing more than 20 hours a week. I think you already look like a degenerate, and playing more will make you look like more of a degenerate. And if you look at people who play machines, the majority of them don't get all excited when they hit jackpots. You know, they look kind of like zombies. So most cases that I see of people trying to Hollywood fail miserably. You're much better off just acting like you, because when you try to act like something else, to me, it just always looks ridiculously fake. So I would not bother with that. And look, everything ends eventually, and we all play this guessing game when it's over, after we get barred or they fix the machine or whatever. Oh, I should have done it this way. I should have done it that way. But, you know, I think that's sort of a fool's errand to go down that road. So I would play as much as you want to play and take as much money as you can, and eventually you'll get barred or they'll fix the machine and it'll be over.
All right. When scouting an AP game where hole carding is involved, do you insist on it being 100% readable all the time, or do you accept a lower percentage? If so, how low? Also, do you adjust your expected EV based on this percentage? For example, if you only can read 7 out of 10 hands, do you assume your return to be only 70% of the EV if you could read 100% of the hands?
Well, yes. I mean, actually, it's 70% minus the house edge on the hands where you had no edge. But I don't really think about it in terms of, you know, calculating an EV that way. I mean, I sort of do a calculation of what is this game worth per hour, right? And so if a game is worth $500 an hour, but you can only see it half the time, then it's now worth $250 an hour or whatever. First of all, I should say I can barely see my hand in front of my face anymore, so I'm not going to be able to see a hole card. Everyone I know plays games that are not perfect. I do remember when I first started playing hole cards back in the early 80s, they were so prevalent that we didn't bother with games that were not 100% because you could just find them anywhere. But that is not the case anymore. So you're just going to have to make a judgment on what you think the game is worth. Most people are really bad at estimating how well they see. They think they see great, and often they don't. So you really have to be careful about the number of mistakes you're making, especially on those games where you're not getting it all the time, or you think you might have got it. And guessing can be very, very costly. So, Unfortunately, I don't have a black and white answer. Yes, you should do this.
Well, I'm pretty sure our listeners aren't looking for black and white answers. AP is pretty nuanced. And how you deal with those nuances, they're looking for the old pros to give them some clues. Another listener, he said, I recently had a very good year playing video poker, primarily NSU Deuces Wild, which was positive after comps, points, promotions, mailers, etc. The majority of players at this location all think they're professionals and consistently try to dictate what game I should be playing to the point where they would follow me around and cry about the game I was playing. He asked me, being an actual professional, what is the best and politest way that I can tell these people to go to hell? And my answer is, that's not my style. I accept that I'm a minor celebrity in the video poker world and try to be polite to anyone who comes up and talks to me. If they seem to want an extended conversation and they aren't a close friend, I'll tell them I'm working and need to concentrate on the game. Most of them take the hint. Don't get a lot of people trying to convince me I'm playing the wrong game. Generally, they assume I'm playing the right game, and they try to figure out why. Sometimes they come up and ask why I'm playing this particular game instead of another one, but they're asking, they're not telling. Sometimes I'll give them a straight answer, and sometimes I'll say I'll probably write about this some point down the road, but for now, it's still my secret.
Yeah, we had a guest on the show a while back, Lee Jensen, who has a blog called AP Street, and he had a recent post where he was talking about a typical trip that he was on, and it was a good post, but one of the things in it that struck me was they found a dealer who was making a procedural error, and they were playing this game, and another crew came into the casino and saw them playing the game, and the other crew was speculating that they were playing a bad game and may not have had any edge at all. And I had to smile at that, because if I were on that game, that's what I would love to have happen. I would want them to think that I'm playing a bad game, because it's more dangerous if they think, why is he playing that game, and try to figure out why, because then they might learn something. So, you know, depending on how well you know these guys, I would either play into their idea that you're playing the wrong game and, you know, start to make up some stuff about how this machine is hot. So, you know, that's why I'm playing it, because it's hot. And let them think I'm an idiot. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's what I would do. I'm not going to tell them go to hell.
Well, sometimes you have to. Sometimes they just keep at you and at you and at you and at you. And eventually you need to get rid of them.
I mean, actually, in my own case, if someone approaches me, I would often say, don't talk to me in a casino. I mean, it not only can it be bad for me, it can be even worse for them. So, you know, I first got into the Griffin book 20 years ago because a guy walked up and talked to me in a casino that shouldn't have. You know, and he had heat on him. And that was how I first got into Griffin. So, yeah. Now, if I were playing video poker, it probably wouldn't be as bad. Unless it's a guy who has heat on him, and then I don't want him talking to me anyway. But, you know.
All right. Different subject. A listener wants to know, to Richard, have you ever done play in a casino where you've not given any identification or told anyone your real name, or where you're from, but had one of the floor supervisors or pit boss call you by your full name without knowing fully what you are? If you have had this happen, how did you handle it? And did you ever go back to that location and play?
Well, I actually have two different versions of this, right? So the first one is where bosses want to see your reaction, right? This usually means there's a flyer out on you. So a flyer came out, John Smith, card counter is in the area, and they want to show you how smart they are by showing you, oh, I know who you are, right? So I'm going to call you by your real name. Or they think it's you, they're not 100% sure, and they want to see how you react when they call you by that name. In the old days, the Griffin Agency used to page you by that name to see how you react, because 9 guys out of 10 are going to look up and around when they hear their name being paged, right? So Griffin would catch people that way. The best thing to do is just get up and leave. Is you know, without saying anything, just get up, don't say a word, head straight to the door. Do not go to the cashier's cage. Just leave. And realize that there's probably a flyer out on you. Now, the second version of this that happens to me is occasionally I will walk up to a table and somebody will go, "Oh, Munchkin." In that case, I can't just pretend it's not me. That's a different thing. And unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, but 40 years ago, I was a dealer, and every once in a while, I run into somebody who's still in the casino business that remembers me. So, you know, when that happens, I actually just go, "Oh, hey, hi, how are you doing? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. You're still doing this, huh?" You know what I mean? And I stop playing, but I will just have a conversation with them, because often it's not heat. When that happens, it's not heat. It's somebody who knew me at one time. And then one time a guy just recognized my voice, which I've talked about on the air before because of this show. And that was a little bit weird. I knew that someday that was going to happen. When it finally did, it was a little bit weird. It wasn't any heat or anything, but
and the guy was cool about it. He called you Mr. M or something.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. The same listener says, without giving up any specific games, do you still believe there are decent side bets that can be taken advantage of for a decent amount of money? It seems like the biggest way to gain an edge is to hold card on the majority of games. Is he wrong in this assumption?
Well,
how much do you want to tell?
So yeah, right. So I mean, yes, hold cards can be a big edge. That can be a big edge. Side bets usually are not a big edge, because normally the limits are very low on side bets. So for low rollers, they're kind of great, because you can have a good size edge, and the most you can bet is only $25 or something anyway. So, you know, it might be good for them. So side bets generally are not really where a lot of the money is. Hole cards can be. There are certainly other things that can have much bigger edges, you know.
All right. The same listener continues. When he finds games to hold card, he can't seem to make them last for more than a few visits, even without betting in big chunk. What's a good way to handle a hold card situation to milk it and bet? Is it go smaller amounts or to go full guns blazing and try to grab as much as possible?
I think the best method is to use a big player. So it's always going to last a shorter time if the guy who can see the card is also the one betting the money, because the guy betting the money is the one who's going to get all the scrutiny. So, I would say the best bet is to use a big player. The second thing I would say is, whether you decide to milk it or slaughter the cow would depend a lot on competition. If you're in a place where there are a lot of other people frequent that casino, come through scouting, they're going to find the game when they get there. So I would tend to try to bet as much as possible, you know, and burn it out. Now, if you're in the middle of Minnesota in the winter, in some small casino that people don't go to very often, well, then you might want to try to milk it if you want to live in the middle of Minnesota in the winter.
Sounds cool. Another listener He has obtained a copy of James Grosjean's Beyond Counting Exhibit CAA. He wants to know how he takes in all that material to gain value from it. There's a whole bunch of numbers there. Richard?
You know, it's a reference book. I mean, yes, I just read the whole thing. It's an enjoyable read, but it's a reference book. And what most people don't realize that have read the book is how much is really in it, because you can only look at so many pages of charts, you know, without your mind going numb. But invariably, when I have found something and wondered, oh, I wonder what the edge would be if we did this. Oh, well, it turns out it's in the book. You just didn't see it because you didn't know that the opportunity existed. So it's not a book that's going to teach you how to do something. It's a book that once you know what to do, it's going to tell you what your edge is. So how to best use it, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, as I said, if you ever have a question about a game where you get an idea about how to beat a game, well, then you should go check it, because there's a very good chance that the answer to your question about, gee, what's it worth if I know the dealer is going to hit with a nine on the next hand, you know, well, the answer will be in the book.
Okay, now this, how to read that book, is a problem I would like to have. James won't sell me a copy. He says there's some errors in the fourth decimal point on one of his tables, and he doesn't want that misinformation out there. He was not at all interested in continuing that discussion.
Now, hey, Bob Nersessian told me that he doesn't have a copy of the book.
Well, so. He had the earlier version, and somebody ripped it off from his office.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, I have seen the book. I'm not capable of mastering it all the time. Were I to find a particular beatable game that was described in the book, I would take time to master, at least semi-master, that part of the book, and then go attack the game. I don't know how much I could have memorized at age 25, but at age 70, my memory isn't what it used to be. It's different in video poker. Once you're practiced at it, you can learn a new strategy in a fairly short period of time. And usually the game will be there when you finish learning it, unless it's a once-a-century promotion where people are lining up, and if you give up the machine, you're toast. A lot of the tables in CAA are related to seeing one or more hole cards. If you leave the table to go learn how to play it, that opportunity may well be gone by the time you get back. Different listener. There are IGT Game King machines that have video poker on them, and also slots and Keno. If the casino pays different slot club rates for video poker versus Keno versus slots, how do you know which rate you're getting? Basically, you just look and make some inferences. Most casinos give you their formula for points and display the points on a screen. If this casino awards 1 point per dollar at slots and Keno and 1 point for $2 at video poker, well, you pay $10 coin in. If you've earned 10 points, you're getting it at the slot or Keno rate. If you've only earned 5, you're getting it at video poker rate. Usually, the entire machine pays points at the same rate. So if you're somebody who likes to play slots or Keno, you'll earn more points if you play them on standalone machines rather than machines that also have video poker on them.
Which means you really get screwed if you play slots on those machines.
All right, this is might be my favorite question from a listener. It says, rumor has it in our group that Richard used to direct porno films in Korea. That is how he built up a large bankroll. Is this true, and where can one obtain these titles? And my comment is, I didn't know about the porno part, so I really want to know how much is true, And I want to know from Richard all the stories about the Korean casting couch.
Yeah, that's a good one. I did make films, not porno, and I did play a lot in Korea, but didn't make any films in Korea, although I sold films to Korea that I made. So, no, I didn't do it. I've never done porn, either as an actor or a director. And
either one on your bucket list.
No, I had no desire there, actually. But the films that I made were really mostly action and martial arts. So lots of car chases, you know, shootouts and fighting. So no porn.
Thank you, Richard, although I must tell you that's a really disappointing answer. Okay. Another listener says, a local casino has blackjack over and under 13 side bet with a limit of $25. Do you think this would be a plus EV play to look into?
Well, as we were talking earlier about the side bets, this is exactly the problem. The side bets have these very low limits. So if you're a low roller and you live in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota where that game is or might be, if you play there, then sure, you could get positive EV playing it. You know, your hourly win rate is not going to be a lot, but as I say, if you're a low roller, sure, go for it.
I'm not sure where people think of these questions, but they want to know who's better at ping pong, Richard or me. And then he continues and says, since Richard has a ping pong table in his living room, he's going to bet that Richard's the better player. Now, if I get to bet, I'll put money that the match is never going to happen. I'm not a competitive ping pong player. My knees are as bad as Richard claims his eyes are.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned last week, all the players seem to not come to town very often anymore, so I don't think I've played in 6 months. So
So I was at a party, and James was there, and he seemed to be a competent player.
He doesn't seem to get to town much, so.
All right. Another listener. He says, I'm a 10-plus years small to mid-stakes poker player, beginning to dabble in other forms of advantage play. He's learned high-low and has double-deck strategy memorized, but he's down $300 over his first 40 hours, spreading $5 to $50. Question. What's the best way to actually confirm that I'm doing this right? I understand variance and not concerned about the money, purposely playing small enough for it not to matter, but I just don't know if I need to study more or if I'm running bad.
Well, first of all, $300 obviously is no variance at all if you're betting 5 to 50. So, you know, you could easily be down $3,000 or more. And you could easily lose for 100, 150 hours. So the only way to really know whether you're doing it right is to go out with someone else who is a competent player and have them sit at the table with you and watch you play and see if you're making any mistakes. When I first started playing, I went on a 160-hour losing streak. And I had someone come out with me four different times to sit at the table with me for exactly that reason. So I don't know any other way to do it, because playing on some software is not the same as playing in a casino. And so I wouldn't use that as a gauge. So.
Okay. The same listener continues. And he said, he's gotten backed off from a small-time game, and it's already noticed heat in one or two other casinos. He lives in Greater Las Vegas. He thinks the back off was because he had the Wizard of Oz strategy card on the table for the first 5 to 10 hours. I assumed I was betting so small, spending 5 to 25 at the time, that no one would care no matter how obvious I made it. The pit boss almost whispered to me that I could play anything except blackjack and told the dealer to stop dealing to me after a shoe where I got a good count and ran well. Question, what's the best way to handle a back off? This guy nodded and left without saying a word. This casino has good video poker and I didn't want to risk anything bad happening. I also just wanted to ask why and play dumb about any sort of card counting. What's the best thing to do when you're noticing heat?
Yeah, so that is the natural reaction for a lot of people is to play that game. Why? Well, you know why. You're counting cards. I mean, don't say anything. You did the right thing. You get up. You walk immediately out the door. Do not go to the cashier's cage. Just leave. You're probably still okay for video poker. They probably won't hassle you. I hope you were not using a player's card when you were doing this. And this idea that they're not going to care because you're only betting 5 to 25 or 5 to 50, well, you're just wrong. Like, pit bosses have not a lot to do, and they get bored very easily. So you make their day when they can go tell their buddy, oh, I just caught a card counter. Yeah. And I've certainly seen flyers on people spreading 5 to 25. You know, I mean, it's absurd, but it happens all the time. So there is no amount that you can bet that you might not get barred. there's no amount small enough where you might not get barred. So, yeah, you get up, you leave, you don't say a word, don't go to the cage, just walk out the door.
Now, he talked about this strategy card. I'm assuming it's a basic strategy card. He didn't say that.
Yeah, I don't think that had anything to do with it. I mean, they're certainly not barring you for having a basic strategy card.
All right, another listener. What kind of mathematical background do each of you have that makes you qualified to do what you do?
None. you know, in any successful team, and I use that word very loosely, I mean, I just have friends that I play with, and it might be a different two or three of us on a given weekend. But any group like that has at least one person who is the math guy who can analyze those things, and that's not me. I'm not that guy on our team. You know, there's another guy who's the scout, a guy who doesn't mind pounding the pavement and spending hours and hours and hours going through casinos looking for things. So, you know, another guy might be the record-keeping guy and the guy who handles things like booking flights and hotel rooms and stuff like that. I mean, different people have different skills. So mine is not, I mean, math was my best subject in school, but I'm not a strong, you know, math person, so.
For me, I had a few upper division university classes in probability and statistics, and econometrics was one of my PhD fields, but I don't know that I use any of that. You need some familiarity with algebra and probability to work out video poker promotions, but the level you need isn't very high. I've learned a lot from posts on various video poker bulletin boards over the years. On these bulletin boards, you learn quickly who knows what they're talking about and who's blowing smoke.
That's true on the blackjack boards as well.
Now, when I was in school, I never dreamed I'd be a professional gambler. The actual math I use had been picked up after I graduated. Were I to do it over again, I would have studied computer programming. I really wish I had the tools to analyze some of the games that are out there, but I don't. Also, in terms of being qualified, I've never been on a team, so that there hasn't been anybody interviewing me to determine whether or not I'm qualified to do what I do. Basically, if I'm convinced I can do it, I only have to convince me. So if I have the bankroll to do it, to survive my mistakes, that's really all it takes for me to be qualified. Were I part of a team, there would be more testing, I'm sure. Here's an ugly question. What is the worst thing that a supposed partner or friend has done to you in terms of gambling only? Do you want this one first or second?
Yeah, I mean, steal. I mean, you know, and it's heartbreaking. You know what I mean? When it's somebody that you think of as a friend. And that's happened to me a couple of times. And as I say, it's just heartbreaking. There are other times, for example, we had a BP one time that we were up in Caesars Tahoe and we were going to go make a play at Harrah's Tahoe. So, you know, 100 feet down the street. And we go set up on the game in Harrah's and the guy never shows up. And we go back to Caesars. He's not there. And apparently the guy had just left the casino, gone to Reno Airport, and flown home with $20,000. So, I mean, that's bad, right? A guy stole $20,000 from us. But it's nowhere near as devastating as when it is somebody that has been a friend of yours for years, and suddenly you find out they're stealing. And as I say, that's happened to me a couple of times. And so, yeah, and the other thing is, I had a guy who I considered a friend who ratted me out to a casino. You know, he called surveillance while I was at the casino and told them that I was a card counter. You know, and basically just burned that casino and that chain in that state for years. That was pretty bad, too.
Yeah, I've been accused of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's no fun to be falsely accused. I was ripped off by Jeffrey Warren Toll. I was playing at the Parks in Bensalem, Pennsylvania, and Jeffrey was supposed to pick up free play afterwards and mail me the money. He convinced me that redeeming free play at a later date was better than doing it while the promotion was still going on. He got me for several thousand dollars. I got some revenge by posting two articles, including mug shots from when he was arrested in Florida, explaining what he had done and urging people to beware of him. He ended up returning about half of what he owed me in exchange for me taking down those two articles. I did take them down, and I'm not going to repost them. He contacted me later for help on something, and I gave him the line of, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." He realized I was never going to trust him again or do business with him, and so he hasn't bugged me since. This is a question for Richard. Would you rather be an AP in today's blackjack world with reduced opportunities, or back in the 1960s when conditions were better, but the possibility of violence and theft was present?
Reduced opportunities? Are you out of your mind? It is so much better today than it was back then. When I first started playing, there was only one place to play. Nevada. That was it. There was no Atlantic City. There was nowhere else. And when you got heated up in Nevada, unless you wanted to go to a foreign country, that was it. Now there are casinos all across the United States, and just so many more opportunities in games other than blackjack. So it's way better today than it was back then. Just by miles.
The only thing I like better about the 60s is I was in my early 20s. And that was a fun time to live. But so be it. All right. What's the nicest comp, Richard, that you've ever received?
You know, I often was not the big player, so I never, you know, I mean, I've had some big suites, but often I would ask not to have a suite because I wanted more airfare comp, you know what I mean? So, you know, Tyson Holyfield tickets were nice. You know, I think I made $10,000 on Tyson tickets one year. So I guess that was about the best.
For me, in late 1999, I got to stay at the mansion at the MGM Grand for the first time. I was playing $25 single line jacks or better. It was during a double points for a month promotion. I was doing fine. Just hit $100,000 royal, and they didn't want me to go anywhere. So, and it was a dead time of the year, so why not? Although the room they put me in was probably the smallest of the suites they had in the mansion, it was huge. The bathroom in that room, which included two televisions, was bigger than my first apartment. There was a dining room table where I could have served 16 people, all comped. 2 years before the mansion, accidentally got another comp that was pretty cool. The Rio, this is before it was associated with Harrah's and Caesars, they had a monthly slot tournament. There was a drawing each time at the after party, and the most people blew off the after party, but there was a dance band, and dancing was one of my things, so we did it. So there was a cruise to the Mexican Riviera out of Los Angeles as a giveaway, and my wife at the time, Shirley, won the drawing once without even being entered. She had entered the month previous, but had skipped the current month's tournament because she had a church-related ladies' function that she preferred. But she came to the awards banquet because of the dancing. The first name drawn wasn't there, which was highly unusual because you put your ticket in right when you're going into the room. So it never happened that it wasn't there, but it did. Shirley's name was the second one drawn. Apparently they hadn't emptied the drum from the previous month. The MC of the event, Kelly Flynn, drew the name. Shirley screamed and went up and collected her prize. Kelly was a friend, and we didn't want to get him in trouble. So after all the players left, we went up and explained that we'd love to go on the cruise, but Shirley wasn't entered into the event this month, and we didn't want anybody to lose their job over this mistake. They talked about it for a few minutes and said, enjoy the cruise. Shirley and I were regulars, and nobody intentionally gave us an unfair edge. It just happened, and everything was cool. Since then, I've been on dozens of cruises to far more exotic places than the Mexican Riviera, but that was my first. It included cool stuff like port fees and gratuities prepaid, and $300 of shipboard money could be spent on alcohol or shore excursions. Pretty cool. All right, what's keeping either one of you from backing and profiting from the next Don Johnson? Richard.
Well, I mentioned earlier that I had this opportunity years before Don Johnson, and the problem was that there was just no way that I could go into a casino with a couple of million dollars on deposit and have them not look up who I am. And even if I was playing crap, actually, my opportunity was to play craps, not blackjack. But even so, if they look me up and see who I am, they're just not going to think I'm there to gamble. You know what I mean? So that's what prevents me is not having that clean name. Oof. And here's the other thing. I mean, we knew that it was a good edge, but I can't trust somebody else with $2 million or something. You know, it's just too much money to... you know, to trust somebody else with, you know.
How much could you trust me with? Now, Don Johnson did not need any financial backing from Richard or me. There were some lost rebates going on there, but there was a whole lot more going on than just the lost rebates. If you go back and listen to our Gambling with an Edge show, Don talks a little bit about... somebody in a baseball cap who was there helping him do the winning.
And I should also say those opportunities are not around the way they used to be. Don kind of burned them out. So, yeah, I don't know of any place in the U.S. that's still giving a 20% loss rebate.
All right. We got lots more questions. We're going to go over some commercials for a few minutes, and then we're... going to come back. South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. each week in July, Monday through Thursday. If you play 1,250 points on slots, reels, or video poker, you earn a copper gift. Red Copper brand, the pans are ceramic-infused copper. Earn all four of the gifts, three frying pans and a skillet from July 31st, from August 3rd. Then you pick up a five-piece red copper square pan set for no extra play. In all cases, you keep your points. In July, every Monday is Prime Monday, which is where the seniors, 50 years of age and older, include slot tournament, a half-off dinner if you play with points, $4 movies, and half-off bingo. The next semester of free video poker classes at the South Point will be on Wednesdays at noon between August 2nd and October 4th. The schedule's posted on bobdancer.com in case you're going to be in Vegas sometime in that interval and might want to attend. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Magic Deal Video Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where periodically you receive 1, 2, or 3 Magic Deal cards, which turn into the best possible cards after the draw. Somewhat similar to Dream Card, except in Dream Card you get one and only one special card, and it turns into the best possible card before the draw, not after. On games like Jack's or Better, where four of a kinds don't pay much, you get a lot of magic cards. In games like Double Double Bonus, where quads pay much, much more, the frequency of magic cards is much lower. Overall, the return on the game is better with the magic cards than if you played five coins per line, but the correct strategy isn't always obvious. All right, we're going back to more questions for Richard and me. What's the nastiest back-off you've had?
You know, I guess it would be... First of all, I have to say, I've been pretty fortunate in not having many nasty back-offs. I attribute that to the fact that I was a dealer, and I think I was very good at seeing heat, seeing things before it got to be enough of a problem, and getting out early. I mentioned earlier that I got barred one time because a guy came up and talked to me in the casino. I got put into Griffin for the first time because a guy came up and talked to me in a casino that shouldn't have. He had a bunch of heat on him. And on that particular trip, my kids were little at the time, and we came up on a Sunday afternoon, and our key wouldn't work in the door. And the maid said, oh, you know, let me call. That happens sometimes. And so the maid calls, and here comes six security guards and the backup shift manager. And they're like, pack your bags and leave, you know. And my parents were staying. They were in from Chicago. They were staying in the hotel, too. Fortunately, they didn't throw my parents out. But, you know, one of the security guys was Filipino, and my wife started talking to him in Tagalog, and she's like, what the hell is going on? And he said, you know, I don't know. This is crazy. Like, you know, I'm there with two little kids. They're like 2 and 3 years old. And but anyway, so the security guards came in, watched us, packed our bags, and, you know, escorted us down and out the door. My parents are there, like, in the lobby, waving goodbye. yeah, so I guess that was about the worst. Really not bad compared to things that have, you know, I've never been forced into the back room. I've never been handcuffed. And I should also say that barrings that happen overseas are always, in my experience, much nicer than places in the United States. I've never had any kind of a, you know, problem. I mean, I've been barred, but never anything you know, nasty overseas. So
I don't know. Mike Diamond tells a story of in the Ukraine where a man named Joseph and a lot of big guys.
Yeah.
That sounded nasty to me.
Pulled his pants down and stole $70,000 from him, from his money belt. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I've been fortunate. I haven't had any kind of really bad borrowings.
Now, for me, generally speaking, I've been treated with kid gloves when I was backed off, partly because I'm a writer and casinos don't want to be trashed in print. The only exception was the Tropicana, back before it was owned by Penn National. It's promised a lot in terms of being grandfathered into a higher tier level if I posted front money. And it was promised by a guy named Craig Crosby. His boss didn't honor, saying Craig didn't have the authority to promise what he did. I got stiff for about $3,000. Most painful back-offs were relationships with females. Now, Richard's been married to the same woman forever. I wish I could say that, but I can't. One lady decided I was a compulsive gambler. In her mind, it was semantics whether I was an AP or a compulsive gambler. Now I believe I'm better off without her, but at the time, it was a drag. Others had issues unrelated to gambling, far more painful to me than gambling back-offs. There's some skills in maintaining relationships. I'm not in the position to brag about mine, but there's also some luck as to who you end up with. Okay, Richard, how many other people have you taught some form of AP to?
Not a lot. I've had quite a lot ask. I've said this on the air before. Usually when they ask, I tell them, go learn basic strategy backwards and forwards and come back. And, you know, 95% of them never come back and ask again. The ones that do usually fail a basic strategy test on my first or second question. There have been a couple of people, a few people that I have taught some specific things. I have been teaching my son some, but he is not the hardest worker in the world. Surprisingly, I mean, I think not as many as what you would suspect. It's been very few and they've been specific kind of cases.
Now, I'm an author and a teacher, so it's probably been tens of thousands for people. But many of them I've never met.
And oh, yeah. You mean if you're talking about people who've read your books or something?
Yeah, read the books and sent me emails and says, boy, have we gotten a heads up. And so maybe I met them once when they came to introduce themselves after class, but I don't really remember their name until they introduce themselves two or three times, and then it usually sticks. The ones who've succeeded the most frequently have been the helpers in my classes who come to class after class after class, and they've heard the same stuff, but every class I say it a little bit differently, not on purpose. It just comes out that way, and answering whatever questions they are. And some of them have become very, very strong video poker players. All right, another question. To me, it's when playing higher denomination games, when you're basically getting a W2G every 5 minutes, how does all that paperwork get processed at the end of your session? Do you have 200 W2Gs? Or is it a summarized variation of some sort? And the answer is it depends on the casino, and it depends on what time period we're talking about. Most of the larger casinos have some sort of an accrual log where you get one W2G at the end of the session. Some have it so you sign in beforehand, and then the machine locks up. You enter your PIN number, and it automatically goes to a accrual log. There's a lot of newer technology. I probably haven't experienced because there are several high limit rooms where they don't welcome my action. Richard, when you were getting to be an AP, who were some of your AP idols and why?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I was sort of obsessed with gambling from the time I was a teenager, and one of the books that I loved was a book called Fast Company by John Bradshaw, which was a profile of six professional gamblers. It was Puggy Pearson, Doyle Brunson, Johnny Moss, Bobby Riggs, Minnesota Fats, and Titanic Thompson. So, you know, I was obsessed with those guys and people like that until I actually got here to Las Vegas and met some of those people. And the loss of illusion sort of came very quickly, where I realized some of these guys were not guys that I wanted to idolize. But then when I first got here and I started counting cards, you know, Arnold Snyder, Stanford Wong, Ed Thorpe, you know, I mean, that was just a tremendous thing to finally meet Ed and kind of get to know him. I guess that was it back at that time when I started counting cards. But, you know, the more you're actually around those people, the more you realize they're just humans with, their own failings and whatever.
Now, I wasn't asked this question, but for me, my idols were writers. Now, you all heard of Stanford Wong, but another one you may not have heard of is Danny Kleinman. Danny wrote about backgammon and contract bridge and was based at the Cavendish West Club in Greater Los Angeles. Compared to New York's Mayflower Club, where people like Paul McGreal, Jason Lester, Mike Senkiewicz, Eric Seidel, Billy Horan, and others hung out, Los Angeles was a backwater of backgammon thought. Still, Danny regularly published all sorts of backgammon stuff, and I learned tremendously from him, both as a player, and he inspired me as a writer. As an AP video poker player, largely I had to reinvent the wheel. I certainly read the authors at the time when I started, Dan Paymar, Lenny Frohm, Bradley Davis, but I didn't think their work was very accurate. The best players at the time were involved in video poker teams, and that wasn't the direction I wanted to go. One advantage you have in video poker that you don't have in blackjack is you're sitting next to the same person for hours at a time sometimes without supervision, and you can talk about things. Once I had insights to share, others shared with me. But they were pretty close-mouthed around me until I figured out a lot of it on my own. Someone wants to know of a discussion of strategy changes to Ultimate X for less than full pay machines. Also, some tips on how I could analyze specific Ultimate X hand properly since there are no formal tools. And he says he'd pay big bucks for Video Poker for Winners CDs that had Ultimate X on it. So my question is, how big would you pay? Jim Wolf, the creator of Wolf Video Poker, offered to include Ultimate X and Quick Quads, among other tasks, for an updated version of Video Poker for Winners for $250,000. The owners of the software, videopoker.com, found that too expensive. But if you're willing to pay that much, we can make this happen. Seriously, I very much encourage videopoker.com to come out with a news release. They're convinced that it's cost ineffective. I'm not personally interested in putting up $250,000 for this, but I'd sure like to find a way to get it done. But keep beating a dead horse is not a good way to maintain a relationship.
I'm surprised that somebody hasn't done it and posted about it. I mean, my experience with the blackjack world and all these new games is there are a lot of really, really smart computer programmers and math guys out there in the table games world that analyze things all the time. And, you know, it used to be there was like one guy. There was James. You know what I mean? But now there are a lot of other guys who take on these kinds of things. So I'm surprised. I would think that there must be similar people in the video poker world, maybe they're just more closed mouth about it.
Well, the best guy at that is JB, and he works for Michael Shackelford on the Wizard of Odds site. So the Wizard of Odds has strategies for a whole lot of games. It has analytical tools for a whole lot of games that are exceptional. The problem with Ultimate X in particular are there's a lot of different levels of strategy you can work at. For example, if you're playing 10 play, each of the 10 lines will have a multiplier somewhere between 1 and 12. So it is possible to have the sum of the multipliers of 10 up to the sum of the multipliers of 120. The 120 would be a dealt full house or dealt something, depending on the game. The 10 would be you have no multipliers anywhere. Sometimes some of the numbers are extremely unlikely, such as you need to get that multiplier, you need 9 royal flushes and 1 4 of a kind on the same 10 hands. And
yeah. No, I realize it's a very difficult thing to analyze, but.
So if you have 119 different. That's not right number. 109 different strategy, 110. That's too much for people to deal with. So if you group it into 5, so you use this strategy for a sum of multipliers up to 30, and from 31 to 49, you use this. You can do that. That's another way to do it. You can use a one-size-fits-all, and you just use the same strategy for all the plays, no matter what the sum of the multipliers are. Even if you have that, there's as many penalty card situations in Ultimate X as there are for any other game, and how deeply do you want to get into that? So it's a handful to make those decisions, and whatever decisions I made on mine that I would want are unlikely to be the same decisions that you made on yours. All right. So we're going to take one more question. We still have quite a few left. So we're going to do this again in a couple months. We've gotten some good feedback on people like these. So this last one is for Richard. And it said, what is your general criteria for adding an AP to your team?
Boy, it varies. Are you related to me by blood? If you're my son, that would be a prime criteria.
Or his girlfriend.
I mean, it would just depend on the situation. Are you Asian? That would be a big plus. I mean, I don't really have a team right now. As I mentioned, I go out when I play. I mean, I rarely play anymore because I'm trying to be retired. But I go out with 2 or 3 people. In the last couple of years, I have made plays with people I had never played with before. It was more like I joined their team. You know what I mean? It just depends on the situation. But I'm definitely not interested in some kind of long commitment. In the old days, we had a bankroll, we had a target, we would play until we hit a target, and I don't do that anymore. If I play, we say, oh, we're going to, go to Minnesota in the middle of winter for 4 days, and these are the 3 guys who are going, and at the end of the trip, we chop the money up evenly, and that's it. It's over. You know what I mean? I don't really have a team, so.
Nor do I. But it's a good question. Thank you, Richard. This has been fun. I actually learned a lot from some of Richard's answers, too. Listening to Richard is a gift that a lot of you are receiving.
Aw, shucks.
As to somebody who's walked this path before, and your path is going to be different than his, but having guidance from couple of old farts is useful information. So thank you very much, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.